This episode is brought to you by NordVPN. Listen up, nerds. No. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea.
What?
Hello, friends. Do you have a computer? Of course you do, because it's not 1987. Hell, you're listening to this on some kind of computer right now. But do you have a VPN?
Oh,
what's a VPN, you ask? Well, my friend, a VPN is a virtual private network and it offers two key benefits: enhanced privacy and security online. But VPNs do a lot more than that. VPNs shield your IP address, change your browsing location, and make online life easier. It's all about safety and security, my friends. But like everything else in life, it's also about watching TV. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. I use NordVPN to access my home content while I'm traveling. Wink, wink. Plus, secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you go when you're traveling. There's over 6,300 servers in 111 countries, and you can find a nearby server for the best VPN speeds. NordVPN is easy to use. Connect with one click or enable auto-connect for zero-click protection. And it's got amazing speed. NordVPN is one of the fastest VPNs out there. And with just one NordVPN account, you can use it on 6 devices. It supports every major platform: Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, even Android TV. I think those are all real. Don't miss out on all the awesome benefits for using a VPN. Go to nordvpn.com/ifanboy today for a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. The link's in the show notes. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/ifanboy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/ifanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 327, brought to you by C2E2 and iFanboy members like you. Welcome to the iFanboy.com Pick of the Week podcast, episode 327. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. I'm here with Josh Flanagan.
Hi.
And our regular co-host, Rod Richards, is flying. He's traveling. He is out of the picture at the moment. So sitting in for him is the internet's Paul Montgomery.
Hello, sports fans.
Awesome. Thanks for coming, Paul. Thanks for sitting in.
Thank you for having me.
Or if you're in the UK, sport fans.
Yeah. What are we talking about, comics?
I forget.
We are iFanboy.com. We like comics. We read comics. Every week we read a bunch of comics. One of us reads all their comics, picks the best one, writes about it on their website. We talk about it on the podcast, along with other books of the week, other topics of interest. So strap in. It's a whole lot of comic fun. And before we get to the show, quick reminder and a warning that this is a review show, so there will be spoilers. And if we spoil something for you, sorry. It's not our problem.
I'm not sorry.
Deal with it. Not our problem.
So Josh had the honor this week of the pick of the week.
Yeah, yeah. You guys may remember in February when I did the Book of the Month review, I did it on Ramon Perez's Tale of Sand from Archaea. And when I read that book, I thought, this is a book I can get behind. And as I said, the thing that most impressed me about it was the cartooning in it. I just think it was really wonderful cartooning. So this week when I saw what really is, it's a licensed tie-in book that, you know, came out in concert with the movie John Carter, was John Carter, The Gods of Mars, number 1 of 5. This is, I believe, the second of their John Carter miniseries.
Well, the second book. They did a mini of the first book, which was the movie.
Yeah.
Princess of Mars.
So they have the Roger Langridge and Philippe Andrade did Princess of Mars, which was fantastic.
So this second miniseries in the John Carter series, I wonder if they're going to keep doing them.
Probably not.
Yeah.
The thing is, there are 11 of the books, and they're not all John Carter books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
More than that, the movie was a huge financial failure.
Also that, yes, sorry.
That's true.
That's the broader point. Yeah.
And that's all you hear about is the huge loss, the movie that failed.
That's not all you hear about, because Paul and I talked for 30 minutes with Allie about how awesome it was.
Right. Yeah. And among our subculture, it seemed like the people in the comics really, really liked it a lot. I didn't get a chance to go out and see it, not any reason. I just didn't have time. But I decided to pick up this book because of Ramon Perez on art. I thought, oh, there's more of him to read. That's exciting. Sam Humphries did the script and Jordi Belair on colors. That's a very good up-and-coming team.
All-star team right there.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
On a book that I hope that this helps not get ignored, basically. And what I got as soon as I opened it up was more of that artwork that I was looking for, and then some.
Taste explosion.
Yeah, it really was something kind of wonderful. Perez has this... It's a cartooning style that is old and new all at the same time. There's not too much on any given page. There are these really strong lines, but it's not like Darwin Cook has like very sparse line, but they're very smooth. It's not like that. It's just a little more lively. It's a slightly rougher, but still very, very clean. One of the things that I really like is that his page compositions are very full and exciting, and they just seem to move. And so when you've got a book that's full of action and jumping around and fighting and swinging weapons and like the pages are just moving constantly and in one direction, inexorably forward. And there's little sort of close-ups on bits of, you know, Carter, like his hand or like his face. And it's just a really interesting and cinematic way to look at a comic book. And then there's a whole segment where they cut back to the notes of Edgar Rice Burroughs and in a completely different style, completely different, of him receiving John Carter's diary. And it sort of cuts back and forth between the adventures that are actually happening on Mars at the same time. God, it was just gorgeous. I knew 3 pages in looking at it, I was like, there's no way any other comics are going to beat this book this week. There just isn't. And it's a little bit hard to quantify exactly what Sam Humphries brought to this. And that's not a slight on him. It's just I don't know, you know, how much this used the original story. I assume a lot. So the sort of imagination of it and the characterizations of it, those were all things that existed. But what he had to do was turn that into a comic book script. And that's actually not a small thing. It's a prose book from over 100 years ago. And what I felt was that, you know, as a comic book, this read very well. I was not being hit over the head with explication and explanation. Things were always moving, but I understood what was happening. I hadn't read the first miniseries either, and I wasn't lost. I mean, it's not a terribly complicated thing. It's an adventure story that is happening on Mars. And I noticed just looking at the pages, we're not bogged down with word balloons. Ever. It's all allowed to breathe. It's allowed to be paced. I think in a certain way, I don't want to say he got out of the way and let the art do its work, but it feels like that's a lot what happened, which sometimes is among the best choices you can make as a comic book writer, is to just let the artist do what they're going to do and guide it in a way. And it all works for me. Like I had a lot of fun reading this comic book. It was a lot of what is missing from a lot of the comic books that I've been reading for a very long time. And I know that because it's this property, because it's a Marvel book, but it's not a Marvel book, a lot of people won't check it out. And I think that is a gigantic mistake. Even if you're only going to go in and look at this wonderful artwork, colors by Belair are very out of this world. And I don't mean that in a like, wow, that's out of this world. I mean, literally, it doesn't look like Earth. She used a palette that is it's almost unsettling. You know, all the there's green and blue people and the rocks are all this reddish, you know, lavender sort of color.
It's like a magenta color. Yeah. And yellow skies and, you know, green blood.
Yeah.
There's a lot of colors per page. The thing with the script that I think is really impressive, and yeah, I guess it is kind of hard to quantify because it isn't a wordy script. Mm-hmm. But even if you look at it, even if you haven't read the original book, if you look at where you go from the beginning of the story by the end of the story, they introduce a lot. And I mean, 10 years have passed since either the first miniseries or the first book or from the movie. Mm-hmm. You can actually look at this as a sequel to the movie as well. It basically works same way. That whole mausoleum thing that's in the movie as well. So it's really impressive how succinct this is.
Yeah.
And how much information you glean just through visuals and through relationships, how John Carter interacts with Tars Tarkas, the big green Martian. And they introduce this heavenly city at the end and a new villain. And they introduce a really major character, Thuvia, the Maid of Mars. That's actually one of the other Barsoom books. That's like the fourth, I think it's the fourth book. So she's going to play a big role. So they do a lot in this first issue, yeah. And they have a lot more space to play around with in the rest of the miniseries. So
I keep saying I'm really a big fan of Perez's art, and I came to it. One of the things I really like is that just by the expressions on John Carter's face, you can get to know almost everything you need to know about him. He's got this smirk, this smile, you know, he's obviously going after his lost love, but at the same time, like when things kick in, you know, he's enjoying that conflict. He feels confident about it. You know, it's very Han Solo like, which I think makes sense. You know, but Paul, you're familiar with these books, so you seem like you were very happy with this adaptation.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've looked at the stuff past the first novel, mm-hmm. but it's establishing this world, and like you said, the look on John Carter's face is so much of what makes this. It's what I think me and Connor and Allie liked so much about the movie is that it is so fun and it is. So it's of another time. Mm-hmm. It's not so cynical. It's just it's a romp. And I think that really comes through here. If you like this, definitely go back and pick up the first Marvel collection, the Princess of Mars. Only problem there, if you can find the single issues, it's probably better because they did the digest with it. Mm. And I'm actually kind of in advance kind of crying over the fact that this art is going to be shrunk down into a little digest.
Yeah.
This kind of art you really want to see, you know, as big as possible. And so enjoy it in single issues. I'd say don't wait for the trade.
Yeah. And keep your eye out for more Ramon Perez.
Well, in general, this was better than it had any right to be.
Yeah.
My only hang up while reading it was that, and I wasn't going to get it, but then I saw that Ramon Perez drew it. I picked it up. Was that I found myself wanting to not read the story in this form because I just bought all the books after having seen the movie. So for me, just my own personal thing is I'm not going to continue on because I want to read the book. Mm-hmm. And have it, and find, you know, experience the story for the first time that way, and not through the adaptation.
They do end up being a bit streamlined in terms of these mini series. It's kind of unfortunate that they have a little bit more real estate, like, you know, an 8-issue thing, because there is a lot of world building that they have to do. So it's tricky. Like the first one, it is much slimmer than like the movie adaptation. Mm-hmm. So it's that there is a trade off there, but. I mean, in terms of doing an adaptation in comics, I don't think it's going to get much better than this with these kinds of creative teams. It's actually kind of crazy just how good these are for a licensed property like that.
Yeah. I think more people, I don't know what the sales numbers were, but check this book out, man. Just do yourself a solid. This is a fine looking comic book.
At least leaf through it and see if you're interested. If you saw the movie, you'll probably be interested. If you're not interested in reading the book, you want more of the movie because you're not going to get another movie. So if you want to continue the story, then you'll get it here.
Well, wait, let's double down, guys. 500 million, then they'll come.
All right. Well, another big release was Batman number 7 from Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo. Arguably the best book in comics continues on. And Paul, you gave a rave review to it on ifanboy.com.
I did because I gave a rave review to the past, you know, issues. I think 5 was pick of the week. That was Josh, you gave it the turnaround one.
The twirly one. That was me.
The twirly one. Oh, that was you. Okay.
I didn't pick it, but.
Okay. Yeah. So I reviewed the last one. Batman's been involved in this big, like, hallucinatory fight with the Talon and this underground gladiatorial thing in the sewers in the Court of the Owl's lair. And now you get a little bit of a bit of a respite from that, although involving jumper cables and nipples. But it's back to sort of the detective Batman, and Batman going back to, because he's just been this like savaged, like basically his body broken, and now he's back to using his mind, because that's, I mean, his greatest gift, his greatest talent is his deductive mind. And a lot of crazy stuff that we found out in terms of the Court of Owls and its connection to Paley's Circus.
Well, before we get into the details of that, we should mention that Nightwing number 7 also came out this week, and DC went the other way with this, because the Batman books are about to all enter this saga of the Court of the Owls.
Night of the Owls.
And with the Court of the Owls being the villains. And they've done no promotion whatsoever. You would have no way of knowing that Nightwing number 7 is intricately linked to to Batman number 7. In fact, half the issue is the same scenes and dialogue that are in Batman. You just get more of it from Dick Grayson's perspective, and then you get the end of the issue is following Dick instead of following Batman. But if you're following this story and you want to read everything, Nightwing number 7 is part of it, which is bizarre. It's not even on the cover. Nothing's mentioned about it. It's just, I didn't even know until I was reading Nightwing.
I don't think you have to read it.
No, you don't have to at all.
It's just, it's another angle, literally, on the shot heard around the world. The, you know, Bruce Wayne punching Dick Grayson, kind of because he was being a dick, but also because there was a creepy tooth that's been in his head for a long time.
This issue, we find out that the Court of Owls have been recruiting their talents from Haley's Circus all these years, and old man Haley was actually pretty awful. And you find out in the Nightwing issue, you find out he's been sending his most promising young men into the Talon internship program, where you are put into a sarcophagus for a while, and then you're
like an Iron Maiden, that has like blades inside it, and you get closed up, and you have to stay in there for weeks until it breaks you. Yeah. So if you want to see just how messed up the Haley Circus end of it is, check out the Nightwing issue. But you do get most of the story.
The Talon that Bruce has the body of was Dick Grayson's great grandfather. And then we find out that Dick was supposed to be the next Talon, or the next line of Talons, until his parents were killed and he went off with Bruce, so they went with someone else.
Lucked out.
Yeah, and so then... Sort of.
Parents murdered, become an undead assassin.
So Bruce figures out that Dick was supposed to be a Talon, and each Talon has a little implant in a tooth. And so he pops Dick in the face, knocks the tooth out, and shows him the evidence that he was supposed to be a Talon also. And it sort of rocks Dick's whole perspective of who he is, who his family was, his whole history. One of the hallmarks of Dick Grayson has been the sepia-toned memories of the life in the circus with his parents and Mr. Haley and the family of traveling circus people. And now it's all
And Scott
changed.
Snyder will destroy that too.
Batman
has pissed on his sepia-toned memories.
No one will have sepia-toned memories around Batman.
Didn't Batman just have like one of those little dental mirrors hanging around?
Yeah,
there's an owl on here.
Sometimes I'd rather just go to the dentist and be punched in the face and have it be over with.
That's not a bad point.
So then at the end of the issue, the Court of Owls activate all of their talons and send them off, as someone online mentioned, in a very release the flying monkeys from Wizard of Oz fashion.
I love the design of the lettering on that page.
Yeah. Yes.
Like an old movie poster. That's my real comment for the book. I really like.
It's very like shit's about to get real. It's pretty exciting. It's a pretty cool event, and it's like there's no like colored rings out there like some DC events get, and I think there's a good story here.
Doesn't Bruce have like a lot of broken ribs and such?
Yeah, he's pretty messed up.
He's messed up. Yeah,
physically he's hurting.
Alfred didn't even know who he was. He was going to shoot his head off. It's like it shows how.
But then, and this happened off panel. He picked up his cape and he put his finger through a little hole and he said, "I'm relieved you're home, sir." That's what happens in every scene in my mind.
Yes.
Yeah. So Batman's hurting. Dick is psychologically hurting, and the owls are now attacking in force. So we'll see what happens. It's been just a wonderful ride these last 7 months so far.
It's just very, very consistent artistically and writing-wise. So.
And I think on Nightwing's side, the art might not be as good, although the Eddie Barrow stuff is really good. But this issue itself puts a whole spin in the last six. Now it really changes sort of everything that we've been reading about Nightwing in the last 6 months. So I think this issue, while of course not as good as Batman, is I think still very good, and it leads a lot of interesting depth to the whole story.
It's a good way to do a tie-in. Like you don't have to read that, but I think you can clearly see that they've done some coordination on this, and they've worked together before, Higgins and Snyder. So it's cool to see this coalescing.
Which one did you read first, Connor?
Batman. Definitely.
Yeah, and I didn't know. I hadn't been reading Nightwing, honestly, and then, you know, to find out from the creators that there's a connection there. I was like, oh, I'll check that out.
So, Batman was the one to read first because that had the better reveal. If you read Nightwing first, I think the emotional impact of Batman 7 is dulled, whereas it's not the other way around. Now, Prophet 23 continues what I think is one of the weirdest but most awesomely weird stories that I'm reading.
Weird but awesomely weird. I agree. It's this is a crazy book.
It's so weird, but it's awesomely so awesomely weird.
The best thing about it is that
I'm just trying to get in a pull quote.
the best thing about it is that the weird escalates. It keeps getting weirder and weirder. Yes. But John Prophet,
explain anything.
Yeah, John Prophet, the main character, who it's told in third person. He doesn't speak, and we have the narrator explaining what he's doing, but he doesn't talk. He's not expositioning, and he faces all of this just with total stoicism and nonchalance. Like, he doesn't give a shit. Like, He loses an arm, and then, like, I actually missed that fact. And then a couple panels later, I'm like, wait, where did his arm go? I didn't see him screaming in terror, you know.
He got blown up, he landed, his arm got ripped off, and then he's got this protective goo on him that coagulated around the armhole.
It's a magic scarf.
And then he fell asleep next to the bones of some alien, and so the scarf grabbed the arm and attached it to his body. He wakes up with an alien arm. It's just,
and he just keeps going, and like something dies in front of him, he just eats it because he needs the protein. Like, he doesn't go, ick, I'm not eating that, or like he doesn't cook it. He just eats it because he has to, because he's like a one man force, and he's just like, he's a juggernaut through this book and going on this weird objective. He's got this thing, you know, his handlers from the past had, you know, said, like, you need to go and it's like repopulating the earth, or like retake the earth from these crazy aliens that have turned them into cattle, you know, generations past. And he just has to deal with it and reset a satellite. And I don't want to give away in case anybody hasn't read this, but the very end, it's like total game changer end of a chapter thing. And I don't know what to expect from the next issue.
I love that we're just on this crazy journey with this guy. Don't know really why, don't know really where, don't know really who, but it's just fascinating to follow him.
It's gross.
Yes.
And but it's just, it's awesome.
And also the art, there's no cheating in this issue or any of these issues. There's no slacking. You're getting your money's worth just from the art alone.
I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. There's some really impressive vistas and stuff, and you've highlighted some of those in the Best of the Weekend panels, and there's some really good landscapes and really good designs overall. If you really kind of stare at these panels, like, it's a little bit crude.
But
like,
that's part of the style, though.
It is part of the style. I am kind of excited for the art change next issue. We're going to get Farrell Dalrymple. So I'm kind of excited to see what other artists do with this. Not that I don't want to see Simon Roy, you know, come back, but I definitely do. But I don't want people to go in expecting that it's really meticulous. Like, it is super detailed, but there's, I don't know, like, you can see the artist's hand in it.
Which I think is great. It's part of the look of it. It's a crude, and crude is I think, a dismissive term, but it's raw. The art is very raw.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, I think that's what's
great. I don't dislike it at all. Yeah. I think there might be some, though, who would look at this and say, I don't know that that's top-notch draftsmanship.
Well,
that's,
they'd be stupid.
Okay.
That's a better pull quote, by the way.
All right.
If you don't like this book, then you'd be stupid.
Now, Josh, last year, Rocketeer Adventures was one of our favorite books. A little bit of a surprise, came out of nowhere with a top-notch rotating creative team taking on the Rocketeer, a character who was made famous by Dave Stevens in the underground comic scene. Now we've got a sequel because the first one did so well.
Yeah.
And I forgot to read it.
That was a bad move.
I had a lot going on.
You know what? Come on. Now, the thing is, and I will admit to you that straight up, you know what? No, that's not necessarily true. I was going to say that the names involved with this are not quite as impressive as the first go round, but that's just specifically for you. It's still an impressive lineup of names. Mark Guggenheim and Sandy Plunkett did the first story, and the second story was written by Peter David, and art and letters by Bill Sienkiewicz. Mm-hmm. And that story, by the way, is titled The Ducketeer.
Nice.
About a duck version of the Rocketeer. And then the last one was completely by Stan Sakai with colors by Dave Stewart. So it was a heck of a lineup, and I would say that the stories were every bit as fun as the last go-round. I'm not going to tell you I completely
understood the Ducateer part, but it was amazing to look at because it was Bill Sienkiewicz doing full on Bill Sienkiewicz, and it was kind
was,
of
was
nuts.
It was it Daffy Duck or was it just
I,
the duck?
I read
I heard
it,
someone
I did,
say
I
that it was
did read him in that voice.
Okay,
whether it was or not, it was that way,
but not necessarily visually. He was under the helmet the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, all right.
But it was Bill Sienkiewicz in a way that we actually haven't seen in quite a while.
Actually,
and then,
it's very much Daffy Duck. I'm looking at it now because the villain is Marvin the Martian.
Yeah, that's right. Which is fine. It was fun. I didn't pay as much attention to it as much as I just looked at it. I really just kept looking and I was like, this is
your face into it.
It was pretty awesomely weird, to be honest.
He nuzzled it.
Yeah. Then, I think my favorite part of it was the last story, which was Stan Sakai. You know, and they're just fun.
It's got game.
Whimsical stories, like it's a dude in the 30s with a rocket jetpack. There doesn't have to be a lot else to it. And then, all the pinups in it were gorgeous.
The Arthur Adams pinup and a Dave Stevens pinup and a wonderful cover by Darwin Cook that Paul did not highlight in the best covers of the week feature, which is
going in your file. It really, the sketch cover of that Darwin Cook was just on its own quite wonderful. Probably better than the finished one.
You update that database, Buster Brown, and then...
It's been in there since Monday.
No, it hasn't.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So full of shit. No.
I did it. I specifically did this book Monday. I did it because I put it in my light week. So it does continue the alarming trend of having a miniseries, then naming it 2 and then putting a number after that, which is awful stupid.
Yeah.
Mm. Like what they did with G.I. Joe Cobra 2 number 3, which that's awful. Don't put that there. Okay. Finally, let's talk about Wonder Woman number 7. There were a lot of notable books from DC to talk about this week in the 7s, I guess.
It's great not to remember numbers anymore.
It really is. It's quite useful.
I have no problem. Renumber everything. Yeah. I don't care. It's fun. I don't worry about it.
But this one was up sort of almost a standalone. And what I really liked about it was that, as you may or may not know, Wonder Woman now is part of the Greek pantheon of gods and mythology. And this issue, she went with her little cadre of people to try to enlist the help of Hephaestus, the god of the forge and of making weapons and things like that. Turns out he made the golden lasso.
Gives her a badass golden whip.
Yeah, and this was... It was a great issue because it showed like... It was the twist that you don't expect coming, and it showed the hubris of Wonder Woman as a character, and it ended on a down note. I love the design of Hephaestus, just like I've loved the design of almost all of the gods. I still think that Mercury is just amazing, and Eros is really interesting,
Do you have a mullet?
Maybe. Mullets?
Do we call that a mullet?
They're making a quiet comeback.
Mullets are like tuberculosis.
It must be stopped.
Mullets.
In its tracks.
In comics... Like, they don't quite go away, and then they come back really strong, and all of a sudden we don't know how to deal with them anymore. The mullet, I mean...
He's got a little scarf.
Yeah.
And he's got sort of an ironic mullet thing going. I think that's what's happening.
Well, if he's a hipster, then that makes sense.
He sort of is. I mean, we don't like using that word, but...
I have no problem using that word. You didn't even live in Brooklyn.
All right.
Or take the subway every day. Anyway, this is Wonder Woman at its finest.
Yep.
7 issues might be the longest I've ever made it into a Wonder Woman book because I've tried a bunch of them.
Definitely,
and
for me.
It's interesting. It's fascinating. I like the fact that it's tied into the Greek mythology, something I used to dislike a lot about Wonder Woman. I used to hate the mythology aspect of it.
Interesting.
I used to just wanted her to be a superhero. I like her superhero adventures. But when it was all about her family and her mother and the island, I just kind of got bored. But here, I really like it because I think it's so different.
Yeah, it's a really cool approach to doing the Greek gods. They're not just like guys in togas or anything. It's... They're in street clothes
I like that they've gone with a really pure concept of the gods constantly warring with each other and bickering each other and their complete disregard for humanity.
Yeah.
They just do not give a shit.
And also they go back into the historical, and this pissed a lot of people off, but the historical reality or not reality, the historical mythology of the Amazons who were brutal.
Yeah.
Absolutely brutal. And it angers Wonder Woman fans who consider her a paragon of peace and love. But that was the old Wonder Woman. This is the new Wonder Woman, and I loved every bit of this book.
Yeah, it was an absolutely wonderful issue, and this could have been a pick of the week on any given week. And it was, and also just as a standalone, I thought it was very nice too.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of comics, that's what we do. You may be interested to go to one of the comic book conventions that are coming up this summer. They're all starting. They're coming. But the first one that we want to talk about is C2E2 from April 13th to 15th. That's coming up fast in Chicago at McCormick Place, which is a large complex. There will be many luminaries of comics there, including Mark Silvestri, Amanda Connor, Tony Moore, Joe Kubert, Sean Murphy, Tim Seeley. I can't imagine that Brian Azzarello, writer of Wonder Woman, won't be there, as Chicago is his native city. You could also meet Anthony Daniels. That's right.
Thank the maker.
Thank the baker. This oil bath is going to feel...
I'm
going to
be so sad when this ad ends and we can't do thank the maker jokes anymore.
The tickets are $50 for the entire weekend. Or you can get a VIP package with perks and all sorts of stuff. You get in early, get backstage, meet people, things like that. Go to C2E2.com. You can find out all about it. There's a heck of a lineup going on. It's a really fun show.
We should note that Paul has canceled his appearance. So if you're getting your 8x10s hoping to get signed by Paul, he will not be there.
I might have some people on the floor with some 8x10s just handing them around. I will have some kind of presence there in spirit, but maybe next year.
Should get on a video screen that somebody carries around.
I know, exactly.
That was on an episode of Psych this week. All right, so Justice League number 7 was important for a number of reasons. One, it was the first issue that took place in the present time. Two, it was Gene Ha filling in for Jim Lee. And three, it was the premiere of Shazam, the first part of the Shazam backup story. A couple of points. One, the time jump didn't seem to change anything with the group and dynamics of the team. It read pretty much the same as in the past. Although I do really like kind of cocky asshole Green Lantern. It's nice to have a character that... it doesn't necessarily get along with everybody else. It is kind of a jerk in a team setting because it creates tension. Number two, Gene Ha's new style isn't as good as Gene Ha's old style. I know we say that a lot about artists, but it's a different kind of style. It's a rougher edge style. It's not as smooth, and it's still good. I do quite like it. I liked it here a lot, but you know, if you look back at Top 10, it's not the same.
Well, and it's hard to say that any change from what he did in Top 10 or stuff like that would be, because I love that.
In my head, when I hear Gene Ha's going to write a book, I picture automatically Top 10, and then when I open the book, it's not Top 10 style, and I go, "Urgh."
Yeah, and that's
it's still good in a different way. And three, the big twist in the Shazam backup, which had a lot of people up in arms, was that Billy Batson is a little bit of an asshole.
Wow, that's a strategy that hasn't been applied to comic books before.
He's in his orphanage getting interviewed by a prospective couple who want to take him in, and then the couple leaves, and Billy turns to the woman in charge of the orphanage and says, "The suckers, I hope those idiots take me in," and she's just trying to desperately get rid of him. Which either he's going to be an asshole through the whole thing, or it's going to be a character arc where he starts off as an asshole and being Captain.
He's on Young Justice and same old Big Red Cheese kind of Billy Batson Shazam, and it totally works. He can be square.
One thing I really liked about the update was that he doesn't work at Wiz Radio, which would be ridiculous in the modern day world. He does podcasts, which makes sense.
So it's kind of interesting. Is that a job though?
No. Oh, well, okay, good. For some people, but.
How old is he?
He's the same young little Billy Batson kid.
Okay.
He does podcasts about the orphanage, I think.
I was going to say, he doesn't have to have a job if he's a little kid.
Yeah, that's true.
Hobby.
He just used to work at the radio in the 30s and 40s comics, and that was fine back then because kids worked in factories. But then now they don't do that anymore, so.
Right.
And they had eight fingers. I wanted to make a note of the Sixth Gun number 20. First of all, when I was looking up the number, I was like, wow, 20. Go you. That's really impressive.
It is impressive.
This was, I guess, sort of the coming of age of Becky Montgomery. This is the way that I would describe this one. This has been consistently good the entire way through, and I haven't dropped off. I haven't lost interest. Been a really fun book, and we keep learning more and more things about it. It's great because the characters get to develop and change, and there's still so much that we don't know. And it's been, every issue that's been coming out lately has been better than the one before it. It's just a ton of fun, and it's this sort of sad down note ending, and we keep learning more about the guns. And again, I just really enjoyed it. This is one of those great series that keeps moving on.
What about Dark Avengers? Tell us about that book.
Oh, Thunderbolts 171. I love this book a whole lot. And you know who else would like this book? People with toe fetishes would enjoy this a great deal. Did you guys read this yet?
I actually missed it on the stands. I love this book, and I just, for whatever reason, forgot to grab it. But you can spoil away.
Some beautiful Kev Walker art. This is like a little standalone issue featuring Songbird. And she goes off on a vacation to Tahiti. And, Songbird's sort of like, known pretty much as being a Thunderbolt. I mean, she was a villain before that, but she's basically, we know her as the standby stalwart Thunderbolt. And she finally gets a bit of a break, goes to this island, meets a handsome island guy, who takes her off in a boat. And unfortunately, she is abducted by a super fan who is Dr. Lumiel Dorcas. who created Tiger Shark, and he's like an evil geneticist who apparently was recently or at some point in the past killed by Namor. But he points out here to explain why he's back, he did implant regenerative starfish cells in his body, so he was able to reform after being crushed by Namor. So he's back and doing some creepy experiments. There's some really scary images in here. Songbird gets the side of her head shaved, and she's got stitches because he went in and basically was tooling around with her link to the Thunderbolts thing and gave her, her voice back, her Songbird voice that gives her her powers. So she's sort of like Black Canary. And she wakes up and there's a sea urchin mutant guy, like a little dwarven urchin thing with spikes and stuff. And he's licking her toes because he can't help himself. And yeah, this is pretty fucked up and a very good, very beautiful book. And by the end of it, Songbird is in a very different place than she has been for a while. And I'm very sad to see Thunderbolts going. And even if it is the same creative team doing Dark Avengers, I will miss being able to say T-Bolts, because that's a great name for a book.
It really is. This feels like the book that Marvel will not acknowledge, but they all like it a lot. So they just keep putting it out. It's like, it's this great book that they have to.
It's so good. It's my favorite Avengers book.
Yeah, very good. Hey, what's this Rage More?
Rage More is a state of mind. It's a place. This is, who did this? This is Jan...
Michael Vincent?
Jan Stranad.
Oh, damn.
Jan Stranad. And art by Richard Corbin. So Event Comics, Richard Corbin, black and white. It's basically, the cover is basically an anthropomorphic castle. Looks like sort of like Castle Grayskull lifting a woman over its head with its mouth wide open, about to devour this woman. And this is sort of a Victorian sort of creepy castle horror thing with some people who are trapped in this estate. Basically, this castle was created in an arcane way centuries ago, and they never finished it, these pagans who were building it, and it kept on going and built itself over the years in a kind of reverse erosion kind of thing. Yeah. And basically it's like a sentient castle, and this greedy uncle of the young man who owns this estate with his father, who's gone completely mad and runs around naked. This uncle has come with his inverted commas daughter. It's his hired daughter, not really his daughter, have come to check out this place and basically gain custody of it. And it doesn't quite work out for them very well. This is a mini series, but I believe each of these, it looks like each is going to be like sort of standalone about evil things that this castle does. One thing to note, really gorgeous, as always, Richard Corbin art, but he's doing something weird here. And I only know Richard Corbin through Hellboy stuff, unfortunately. I haven't read his older stuff, so I don't know if he's done this before, but there's like a digital shading thing going on where there's black and gray inking, but then there's also some kind of digital effect for flesh tones, and it's kind of weird looking. Mm. So I wish that wasn't there and it was just clean black and white art, but otherwise it's Richard Corbin, it's Event Comics.
In the early 50s, they would have done this, and there's an 8-page story from EC.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sounds cool. Now that it's the end of a crayon drawn era.
I very famously panned the first issue of Titan Titans, famously amongst us and DC PR. But this is the final issue, issue 50. 50 issues of Titan Titans is worth noting and celebrating. I've read a couple randomly since then, and I picked up this one because it was the final one and I wanted to see what would happen. This book is great. I really blew it on that review in the first time. I really wish I'd been reading this all along. It's funny. Really, there's a lot, from the ones I've read, a lot of poking DC in the eye happening in this book.
Yeah, they do that a lot.
This issue was all about making fun of the reboot. Just a lot of talk about costume changes and why is everybody wearing different clothes now and no one understands. And Beast Boy dresses up as Superman, but his briefs fall off and because briefs are no longer in. And then Superman shows up in his jeans. And it was just very funny, very cute, wonderful art. Also very touching, too. It really straddles that line of touching and funny and adventurous. And then at the end, there's a little preview for the next book that Balthazar and Franco are doing, which is Superman Family in the same style. It'll be Superman.
I'm on board for that.
I'm actually going to pick it up. Now that I blew it on Tiny Titans, I'm going to pick up Superman Family.
Got a little crypto.
So. I'm actually on like a all-ages book kick. I've been picking up all the all-ages books and really liking them more and more. I don't know. I think it's just because it's so not cynical and annoying. So
I think that's totally it. Like, it's the same thing that I mentioned about you know, the John Carter book that I picked up, or just other books that are just like the Peanuts book, or just,
Reed Gunther.
Yeah, Reed Gunther.
Snarked. Great stuff.
Fun books. Rocketeer. Rocketeer is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
So the Tiny Titans 50 was funny. You don't have to know anything about it if you want jokes about DC and or want to see wonderful art or not. It's up to you. Tiny Titans 50. So those are the books we read this week. We want to highlight some of the user reviews. You can go to ifanboy.com/comics. You can make your pull list. You can rate and review your books. If you write some reviews, you can get them on the show. But first, let's talk about the top five picks of the week amongst the community. If you go to ifanboy.com/comics, you can also make your pick of the week and vote along with everyone else. The number five community pick of the week was Amazing Spider-Man 682. Yeah, 682. Sorry, the computer's very far away. 1.8% of you made it your pick
like
of the week.
I didn't screw it up.
No, it's on a laptop and it's across the table. Number four was John Carter, The Gods of Mars. Number one, the official iFanboy pick of the week. That was at 3.7%. Number three was Prophet 23 at 5.1%. Number two was Wonder Woman number seven at 10.8%. And number one was Batman number seven, 71.8%.
All great books.
Another decisive victory for Scott Snyder's Batman series in the community picks of the week.
They really seem to like it.
Yes.
Kingdom of Heaven checked in with Rebel Blood number one, new series. He gave the story a 5 out of 5 and the art a 5 out of 5. That's a very high rating. And the pick of the week percentage of it was 1.3. I think it was just out of the top five. It was either six or seven. It says, it takes a lot to make me care about a zombie story. I never got into The Walking Dead, and the sea of zombies movies is so vast that unless it really has some clever twist like Fido, then I get bored. But Riley Rossmo and Alex Link have my undivided attention. There's no real twist here. They haven't reinvented the genre. These are your usual hostile, growling beasties with weird flesh sacks growing out of them. What grabs you is the way that they tell the story. It's not linear. There are lots of flashbacks, fantasy sequences, characters from one moment in time narrating over another. It took me a second read to grasp the structure of it all, and therein lies the fun of the issue. Watching Link and Rossmo lay down the puzzle pieces of our main character's life, his relationships, and his dreams of being a hero. This is Riley Rossmo's next project. You may know him from Proof and
Green
then after
Wake.
That, Green Wake. Paul, you read this.
Yeah, Josh Christie did a review of this on the site, so check that out. I read this as well. It's really ambitious, and like Kingdom of Heaven says, there's some really interesting fantasy sequences and flashbacks going on that make for a very interesting structure. I'm very curious to see where they go with it in issue two, but there's a lot of stuff where the main character is driving in his truck, and he's imagining what could happen when he gets to a certain place, and he imagines different scenarios. And that can be a little disorienting when you're reading through it the first time, but it's supposed to be that way. I'll be interested to see how that continues in the next issue. So definitely on board. And great Riley Rossmo art.
Closet Squirrel reviewed Deadpool number 52 and gave the story a 5 out of 5 and the art a 4 out of 5 and 0.8% made it pick of the week. And Closet Squirrel says, it was not too long ago, so there were no less than 7 books with Deadpool in the title that we all wish Deadpool were dead. Now it seems we're getting our wish. Deadpool, as a character, has had a bit of a rocky path over the last few years, ever since he stopped being Cable's best bud. But finally, Deadpool's back on track. These last few issues have brought the old Pool to a level of entertainment he once was at. Once Deadpool has a nuanced, multi-level character filled with grief and self-loathing masked by desire to maim, somewhere along the road, he lost what made him special, but with the current arc, he's starting to come back.
Deadpool has been fine in the pages of Uncanny X-Force, I just want to say. If you're talking about solo series, I don't know.
None of us can speak to this, but I will say that yeah. But Daniel Way has been on this a long time. He's put together a heck of a string on it. They checked. I was like, well, it's the same writer. They pared it down, and now the Deadpool fans are more happy. I will hope the best for them is what I'm saying. That's the comics of the week. If you want to make your picks and pull us, go to ifanboy.com/comics. You can rate them, write your reviews, and maybe we'll read them on the show. I don't know. I can't guarantee it.
Email time. Will from Norwalk, California. Is Norwalk in California?
There is.
It's probably a lot of Norwalks, actually.
It's in Orange County.
In California. Good, Paul. Will says, I was wondering what your opinions were of the AMC show Comic Book Men in relation to pop culture geeks and how they are perceived by the rest of society. Personally, I think watching 40, 50-year-old men getting, quote, weak in the knees over seeing the first appearance of Wonder Woman isn't helping our cause. Though I also believe that a bunch of Brad Pitts on camera wouldn't be a good representation either. All this being said, I enjoy the show. The conversation sequences where they speak of the absurd quirks of classic comics and such resemble conversations I've had before. So what do you guys think? Have you watched it? Will you stick around for season 2?
God, did they pick it up for season 2?
They haven't announced anything.
I watched the first one, and I don't want to say I was angered at how we are being represented, because I don't necessarily, I don't know, think of us as a subset.
Collective.
class, a collective. I think there are very different branches of comic book fans, as there are for any fandom, if you want to call it that. I just got annoyed with this very early on, where they, you know, talked about who's the hottest, you know, superhero, you know, who they want to date in the beginning. And I was like, come on. Like, and it's there's not a whole lot of sales going on in this comic shop. It's all it's like Pawn Stars. It's like guys coming in who want to sell their, you know, Kirby Thor posters. And
well, that's a very deliberate producer choice to make it like the hottest show on cable.
Right.
So, I mean, that's unfortunate. I could tell from the previews I would not be interested in this show, so I didn't watch it.
I am the same as Connor. Yeah. I also was really turned off by the reaction of some of the cast towards, on Comics Alliance, they wrote a particularly scathing review.
Yes, they did.
The letter that they got back was even worse, and I was like, that's not going to help anybody. I think the same thing, just from the, and I didn't see it, I can't speak to it. I think that Connor and I have both grown out of the Kevin Smith mode, which we were both very much into.
I have as well. Yeah. I was a big fan as well. And yeah. But it's not my scene.
Well, there was a time that he was very important to me, I would say, and also just for what somebody could do with just their wits and a keyboard, basically, and just being a very good speaker. And I don't know, I've gotten away from it a little bit, and I saw the trailer and I just thought that's not what I want. And what I've heard about it's not, I think, a representation that's particularly helpful to a medium that is struggling because people won't check it out because they think it's not inclusive, or that all of that they think a comic book can only be one thing when really it's just a way to tell a story, and it can be done by there's geniuses who work all over comics, and I don't know.
I'm not concerned about the larger perception of the comics industry or their fans. I just think if anybody is watching The Walking Dead and then they start watching this, they might be intimidated from going into a comic shop, which I know when I was younger, I was kind of afraid of, like, you know, the guys who worked in there were kind of, it's, you know, it's their club. Mm-hmm. You know, and they don't really necessarily want people coming in there. I'm lucky enough to have found a comic shop that is very welcoming, and it's like, you know, Cheers in terms of a retail store, but
there's always a drunk guy there.
But there are definitely people who aren't as lucky, and I don't know. I think that it would potentially hurt potential fans who would want to check out books.
Our next email is from Brandon, who has a bunch of questions. So what I'll do is I'll read a question and they will answer it, and then I'll go to the next one. Okay. So. That's how this will work. Brandon says, this year, a few friends and I will be going to San Diego for our first Comic-Con, first convention of any kind, actually. And since you guys are seasoned pros when it comes to comic conventions, we have a couple of questions that maybe you can help us with. Now, we get this email a lot every year, but it's important to revisit it because it's con season and people haven't been before. So Brandon's first question, what are the most important days to go? We plan on going for 2 to 3 days, most likely Thursday through Saturday. Would we be missing anything big by not attending the last day?
Sales. That's what the last day is. If you're there to buy a lot of stuff, stuff goes on sale the last day. But if that's not important to you, that's fine. But all the big stuff usually happens on Friday and Saturday. Conversely, that also means that that's when it's the most crowded.
Right.
Elbow to elbow, you know.
Especially Thursday, Friday, because Saturday's a big media day. So a lot of the people on the floor go to the panels, and the floor is less crowded than it is Thursday, Friday when there's less of those panels.
Mm-hmm. All right, next question.
2, what's the procedure for getting autographs and sketches? I'm assuming it involves waiting in ridiculous lines and costs money, but how much? Is it a fixed rate or more of a tip system? If it's a tip system, what's a good tip to give for a sketch or an autograph?
This one is you're not quite there. Your line depends on who it is you're talking about. If you're talking about Jim Lee, big line. If you're talking about who are a lot of some of the best comic artists today, you'd be surprised. Make sure to check out. Do you want to do a little research on this ahead of time? If there's a sketch that you really want from somebody or a commission, get in touch with them ahead of time. Find out when they're making a list for that. Find out what they're going to charge. Charging that can be anywhere from $10 to several $100s. You know,
depends on who it is. And also,
if you go to a publisher signing, I mean, you can get a little quick sketch free sometimes, but you're going to have to wait.
Yeah, those are bigger lines.
The other things, if you want a full-on commission, don't wait until San Diego. Actually check out the artists you're interested in. See who's going to be there. Follow them on Twitter. Look at their blogs. A lot of them will have like a sort of a list in advance, and they'll have stuff. Like they'll prepare a sketch so that you can pick it up at the convention whenever you meet up. So that way you don't have to wait in line.
But it's not a tip system. You got to pay, and it depends on who you're getting it from.
Exactly, yeah. And so you're talking about the more high-end commissions, like $60, $100, $200 sometimes, depending on how many characters.
That's not high-end.
Hughes breathes on you, it's $600.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm just saying, like, if you're calling them sketches, yeah. You know. Yeah. And if these are your first ones,
some of the sketches, like some of it's kind of expensive. But no, you're absolutely right. You know, find artists that you really like and go for it.
And autographs, usually they don't charge for autographs.
Yeah,
so
but you know, like if you're buying it from like a table,
unless it's Lou Ferrigno,
they're there. They want you to buy something. You know, buy a book, buy a thing, or you know, if you really want to get your thing signed, bring the book that proves that you already bought it or something like that. Although you may not want
really to fun it. Thing to do. Try to take a picture of Lou Ferrigno without him knowing. It's no, a lot of fun.
It's not. All right, Brandon's next
I've
question.
I've done it.
Question is, what's a realistic amount of time for autograph sketches to shoot for as far as lines and time goes? I was hoping for at least to get Kirkman to sign my Invincible hardcover, maybe a sketch from Scotty Young, but do you think I'll have time for more than that?
Kirkman could be a multiple hour, even more so. Every year he's more popular. The good news about Kirkman is that he will sit there until that line is gone.
Yeah,
so
passes a lot of time.
Well,
I wouldn't waste that on like Friday morning first thing because you can do that pretty much any time of the weekend.
Yeah,
honestly, like as an autograph, I mean,
watch
sketches are the things you really want.
Watch ahead of time for them to publish the schedules, and you'll know when. You know, is it a waste of time? That depends on what you want and what's important to you. I know that Scotty does a limited number of sketches, and they ain't cheap. So you want to definitely get on that as far ahead of time as possible. Yeah.
Do your homework is basically for the sketches. And then his next question, what are the must-see panels and events at Comic-Con, and do you have to reserve seats for them in advance?
We don't know because they haven't released the panels yet. They do not have reserve seats. That doesn't exist.
They don't have reserve seats, but if you're going to talking about a media panel, like a Avengers panel or Dark Knight Rises panel or some big movie panel, you're going to end up being in line for 6 hours just to get into the panel.
That's your day.
And then even then, you might not get in. Last year, my girlfriend was in line for 6 hours with her friend to get into one of those movie panels, and they didn't even get in. So that's the way it goes.
So if you want to go to one of these, you sort of have to weigh it and say, do I really, really want to see it, or do I want to spend more time, you know, talking to people, going around, you know, meeting other like-minded fans, or hanging out, getting those sketches, shopping.
But if it's a comics panel, chances are it won't be a problem getting into.
Right. Not usually. Yeah.
Although the bigger ones are always full. The Marvel panels, general DC panels, the Batman panels, those kind of things are always full. Mm-hmm. It's a good idea to look ahead of time again when the schedule's published, figure out what you want to see, build your day around those things.
But it's the media panels you got to watch out for because you could get stabbed. There is a precedent.
Yeah, that's true. If you want to sit a football field and a half away from Peter Dinklage, you know you're just gonna have to pay for that in time. Basically,
bring your opera glasses.
Yeah, it's true.
And that was his final question. He thanks us. We thanks in advance. No problem. No problem.
I hope we didn't scare you off. But it's fun.
One other thing. If there is an artist that you really want to get a sketch from, unless you want something really specific, they might have sketches already on their website that you could buy, and maybe you could just go and get it signed. Hmm. Like, that's one thing. If you don't want a really specific thing, like Daredevil slow dancing with RoboCop.
Other side of that is if you do have a specific thing, bring reference.
That's very true. Yeah.
Just do your research on who your favorite guys are. And if your favorite guy isn't that popular, you can probably get something good for not that super expensive. But if you're trying to go for Scotty Young, guys like that, you're going to be paying a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's how they make their money.
He's won a bunch of Eisners.
Yeah. Sorry. Multiple Eisner award winning Scotty Young. So if you have an email us at contact@ifanboy.com. And now let's try to squeeze a couple of voicemails in before the end of the show. Our first voicemail has a tricky question.
Hey guys, this is Jeff from Georgia, and I was listening to the latest episode and thinking about the creator surge, the creator-owned surge that's going on in comics right now with Image and all these other companies, and thinking about Marvel and DC, and thinking also about the amount of editorial mandates that happen at Marvel and DC. What do you guys think about that and how that is affecting the stories that are going on at Marvel and DC? Are editors really at the heart of kind of what is lagging about some of those stories, or is it the writers? I don't know. There seems to be a lag going on at Marvel and DC in my eyes, and so I just want to know what you guys think. Thanks.
Okay, this is a tricky one, as I said. Preface by saying we don't know exactly everything that goes on. We certainly know people work in comics. We hear a lot of stories, so we have some idea of what happens. But, of course, no one knows everything unless they're actually involved.
Editorial – see, the thing is to blame editors outright is probably not right. These are – you know, those are guys just doing their jobs trying to get the comic book out. But when you talk about an overall editorial plan – and that's LinkedIn with sales. So it's sales and editorial, figuring out what sells, what has sold in the past, and how to sort of try to recreate that. That does happen, especially at those big companies. Not entirely. There's pockets of it that doesn't. But when you're talking about big franchise books, when you're talking about Marvel Comics and they have a movie coming out this summer, you know, they have to try to they want to try to goose those numbers. That's what Avengers versus X-Men is all about. This is like, what's the thing that we can, you know, how can we recreate Civil War? How can we do that? And I feel like, you know, I don't know tons of specifics, but I feel like it's very much affecting the books that are coming out today. I think if you were to talk to writers on a very non-public sort of way, you'd probably hear some of that. And then from others of them, this is part of the fun. This is what it is. You know, when you talk, the thing is, when you're talking about Marvel and DC, this is no different now than it's ever been. Editorial mandate, you know, Marvel Comics was Stan Lee. He wrote and editorially directed all the books. You know, that's how it came together. So
that's true in theory, but in practice, yeah. It's actually, I'd say right now we're in a more heavy handed yes. editorial era than we were in the last couple of years.
And that's, you know,
I mean, editorial is always driven what happens in these books because it's a shared universe of corporate characters. So, you know, no writer's got full control over his stories. The editor has to approve them, and the editor's editor has to approve them, and the publisher has to approve them. But that's the overall structure of how these things work. But in terms of the day-to-day, I think right now we're in a heavier-handed
definitely.
Era.
And I mean, you can even – and then you look at DC. You know, they went over everything, and right away, you know, within a couple of months, you started seeing creative changes happening. Those are editorial decisions that, you know, this – creator, you know, isn't doing what we want either from a sales standpoint or a story standpoint, sticking with the rest of it. So we're going to make changes. It happens, and it definitely feels like it's much more prevalent now than it has been in recent years. But that sales are going down. They're trying to do what they can to, you know, this is their method of trying to combat, you know, losing money basically. And you feel it very acutely when over on the other side of the comics racks, you know, Image Comics are not editorially mandated at all. Sometimes to their detriment, you know, to be completely fair, you know, but those are books where the creators have carte blanche. They do what they want. They live or die by that call. It's, you know, it's a part of comics, and it ebbs and flows. And, you know, there are pockets where, you know, I think that if you were to go look at Thunderbolts, for an example, now that's a book that should be hip deep in all of the stuff that's going on. But
it's about to be. That's the thing.
Yeah, but
that's
still
where the editorial comes in.
And we're gonna see that. This is a thing where you see a book that is really good and you like it, but maybe the sales aren't that good, and then you start to see changes like that where they take Thunderbolts and they'll change it to Dark Avengers, you know, to try to fit it in. Now, all through whatever the last big thing that was going on was, the book stayed interesting, but it was a dance. You know, like they were in and out of the event that was going on. Was that Siege or I forget? But
this is no different than any other entertainment medium. I mean, movies are executive driven. TV shows are executive driven. If you don't like that, then you make independent films, or you don't work in TV, or you find a tiny little cable network that doesn't care. But that's how it works when someone else is footing the bill, is that they get to have a say over what happens. And unless you're super popular and super powerful, then you have a track record of making money for someone, then you get more leeway. Otherwise, you have to have a boss who tells you what to do, every other job in the world.
Yeah. The good news is, you know, if you don't like that, a lot of people like that. You know, Marvel sells a lot of comics. They're selling them to somebody. Some people show up for certain kinds of things. Other people show up for other kinds of things. But if you don't like that, there are other comics. There's all kinds of comics available, and that's the thing that I think that we are constantly trying to stress, is that, you know, whatever the comic book is that you're looking for, it's probably out there and it's on the stand. We try to talk about the ones that we like.
It's one of those things where when people are talking about waiting for comics and comics being delayed, they're like, I can't stand the wait. But I never get that, because there's so many other things to read. Like, there's too many things to read, really. So if you're not enjoying something, there is going to be something else that you'll like. So,
all right. Well, speaking of things we like, let's do one more voicemail.
Hey, iFamily, this is Tom Morris from Knoxville, Tennessee. I was calling. My question is, what are your three favorite comic book podcasts you guys listen to besides your own? I was kind of curious, like, what else you guys listen to that's comic book related in a podcast? And what are also just some other just random podcasts you guys listen to? Thanks, bye.
Well, let me ask you guys. Do you listen to any comics podcasts anymore?
No, and it's a bit of a disappointing answer, because the only one I was really listening to for a long time was Tom Versus, and he stopped doing that because he went to do other stuff. And that's, if you follow me on social networks or whatever, I don't often talk about comics outside of iFanboy because that's what my job is, and I just don't want to talk about comics 24/7 or listen to talk about them, which, you know, sounds bad since that's what I do and do a show about, but I can't do comics 24 hours a day. So I often, when I'm not doing iFanboy or doing our own show or producing our own shows or post-producing our own shows or planning content for iFanboy.com or whatever, stuff you don't even see, I often don't think about comics, look up comics. I do other stuff. So I pretty much stopped listening to all other comics content as a result.
Yeah. I have to be in the right mood for it, but I don't always listen to comics podcasts, but when I do, I listen to things like 11 o'clock comics because they also have a very different take on the comics coming out currently than we do, I would say. So it's interesting to look at a different perspective, and those guys are great guys. So I listen to their show. I listen more to creator interview shows.
Yeah.
So I'll listen to Word Balloon when there's a creator that I'm interested in, and Loikomania by the great Pat Loika, who talks to everybody.
He's working a little hard for me to feel comfortable about it.
he has the connections. He knows some guys, and I've had the pleasure of being on his show to talk about The Wire, of all things. So I love his enthusiasm, and he's not so cynical about comics. So that's very refreshing. So I like those things. We were also asked what other podcasts we listen to. I listen to Fresh Air a lot. Again, when it's usually more the entertainment ones and, you know, like directors and actors and writers and things like that I'm interested in. And Radiolab. I'm a big Radiolab fan. I love the way both of those shows are produced. And I like science. And again, it's something different than comics because that's our day job. We hear about that stuff all the time. So something a little bit different. And science, sort of course, so to go with the science theme, which Ryan Haupt does. So big fans of those.
Connor, do you listen to any podcasts?
Yeah, I do. I listen to Tobolowsky Files, This American Life, Mike and Tom Eat Snacks, and that's it, I think. Keeping up with those three is enough.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I mean, basically, I get my dog walks to listen to stuff, and I tend to not listen to comic stuff. I listen to stuff about stories. You know, if you talk about This American Life, it's about stories. Now, that's what I like about comics is stories. Or you listen to, you know, WTF, you listen to Marin's show. It's, you know, people telling the stories of their lives. That's the kind of thing that gets me interested. Other than that, I just listen to audiobooks about Gilded Age presidents.
Well, I do listen to WTF sometimes, depending on who the guest is. If it's someone I'm really interested in, I usually listen to that.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I missed one. Another one of my favorites, Bookrageous, which our own Josh Christie co-hosts. And I'm a big fan of just reading in general, so not just comics. So and they talk about comics sometimes, too, so I definitely recommend that.
Boss. All right. So those are your voicemails. You can call 888-FANBOYS, which is 326-2697, and ask us a question and you know, try to keep the call manageable. Don't go on for a really long time. Those were good questions, though, and you know, keep calling up and asking. We really appreciate that. Makes the show better. Let's wrap this puppy up.
Speaking of other podcasts, actually.
We do other shows other than this one, and I had the distinct pleasure of talking to Dan Abnett for, it'll be out on Monday, for the iFanboy Don't Miss podcast, where we talk about the new Deadwardians number one, which is a new 8-issue miniseries from Vertigo Comics. It has vampires and zombies in it, which is great, but it's the most English horror story you could possibly think of. And we talk about Downton Abbey a little bit, if you believe it, the Occupy movement.
It was a party, and no one wants to say the thing that they're thinking, but someone does, and then everybody's really upset by it.
There's a little bit of that. Yeah, so check it out. It's a great conversation.
I also do the Make Comics podcast for those of you interested in the creative arts of comic books with Andy Schmidt, former big-time editor for Marvel Comics. He's worked on a lot of great books, and former senior editor at IDW. I guess he probably named that book G.I. Joe Cobra 2. Damn it. I got to talk to him about that. And we pick a topic. This last week we talked about making time for making comics, which is certainly something that people struggle with when it's not their day job. And it's not a lot of people's day job. So you can check that out every Wednesday morning. We'll bring you a little bit of combined wisdom, mostly his.
It's an excellent show. If you're not entirely tired of the sound of my voice at this point, you can check out the Fuzzy Typewriter podcast, which I do with my buddy David Acampo, who has a comic book coming out very soon. You can hear about that on the latest show. I don't know if it'll be out by the time this is out, but we did a big roundup of all the Image comics that we're really enjoying right now. So it's probably going to be like two episodes. We had a big, long conversation, and that also involves Timmy Wood, who also writes for iFanboy and does some very funny stuff for us. So I think you'll enjoy that. But we talk about movies, but Josh is going to be on soon to talk about... Yeah, Josh is finally coming on for talking about Game of Thrones. So in advance of the new season. So we're going to be talking about the first book, the first season. So check that out.
Definitely. And go to ifanboy.com. You can check out the Pick of the Week review that I wrote for John Cotter, Gods of Mars, number one. You can check out Connor's Book of the Month review that went up.
We'll talk about that next week because it's a book that Ron really wanted to talk about.
Definitely.
So we'll do that next week.
And all the other stuff that we've got going on. We try to keep things hopping and interesting and give you things to talk about and read about all the time. You can go to ifanboy.com/about to read about the staff and the different places that you can hook up with us on social networks. And you can follow us on twitter.com/ifanboy and facebook.com/ifanboy. How can they get in touch with us, Connor?
Contact@ifanboy.com is the email address. 888-FANBOYS-326-2697 is our voicemail line.
And if you dig us, write us a review in iTunes, or better yet, tell your friends about us, introduce your mom to podcasts, spread the iFanboy word.
Podcasts?
Word. And that's all for the show, people. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Paul.
I am Connor.
I am Paul.
And I am your host, Josh Flanagan.
Whoa, what?
Whoa.
Whoa! Those caveman girls. Take a look at the